You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Madison-based artist tells us about her work to raise awareness of missing and murdered Indigenous women, including a music video she filmed to mark the official Day of Awareness earlier this month. Now, more than 100,000 Americans die each year because of stroke, heart attack, and other causes linked to air pollution. That's according to a 2019 National Academy of Sciences report. Now, a study from UW-Madison finds that over 50,000 deaths could be prevented each year if certain kinds of air pollution were eliminated. Nick Mayu is a graduate student at UW-Madison's Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies and lead author of this study on air pollution. Nick, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us what you set out to find out here.
Yeah, so what we tried to do with this study was understand if we were able to eliminate sources of air pollution from electricity, transportation, buildings, and industry, which we dub energy-related in the study, what would the benefits to public health be? And part of the motivation for this work was that these are some of the same sectors that contribute greatly to planet-warming climate pollution, in addition to air pollution that leads to hundreds of thousands of deaths, like you mentioned.
And eliminating all those sources sounds like a pretty tall order, but why did you want to look at what could happen if you could take those completely off the map?
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge to get emissions reductions on the scale that we look at in here, but really we're just trying to put a stake in the ground to say, if we were able to do this mammoth task, this is the scale of benefit that we could get.
Can you connect the dots for us between these sources of air pollution and diseases that we might not think of an air pollution link, things like lung cancer, heart attacks, and more?
Yeah, well, part of the problem with the types of air pollution we look at here, so we're primarily focused on something called fine particulate matter, which people might generally think of as soot. And the real problem there with this pollutant and why it leads to so much health harm is that it's small enough. So it's about a 30th of the width of a human hair, to give an analogy. And that's small enough that when you inhale this walking around outside during the day at any time, it's small enough that it can bypass your reflex. So if you inhale something larger, you might cough, you might get a cough reflex and emit it back out, and then you don't have to worry about it. But these are small enough that just going about your day breathing, they're able to get deep down into your lungs and potentially even into your bloodstream.
You looked at national data, but you found that the Midwest could stand to benefit the most from getting rid of air pollution. Why is that?
Yeah, so we, like you said, we've nationwide, we found that we could avoid about 53,000 lives, or we could save 53,000 lives, rather, each year by eliminating sources of pollution from these sectors. And a little over 11,000 of those avoided deaths would come in the Midwest alone. Now, there's a couple different reasons for this. One is that wind patterns generally move west to east in the United States, and we're downwind of much of the rest of the United States, which are also emitting pollutants. And there are also large population centers in the Midwest, particularly in Chicago and in Ohio as well. So just the more people you have exposed to air pollution, the more potential benefit you get from reducing sources of pollution. And another factor here is also that we have a lot of coal fire electricity still in the Midwest compared to other regions, especially in the Ohio River Valley with Indiana and Ohio. And that coal fired electricity emits a lot more pollutants per unit energy created. So the potential benefit is greater by shutting down sources of pollution from coal.
You may have just answered this question, but are there low hanging fruits here where readily available changes in air pollution could make a big difference, even if we don't get rid of all of these pollutants?
Yes. Yeah. You preempted the question there. yeah, definitely. The lowest hanging fruit in these sectors is probably coal fire electricity generation. So that's one that we've actually had a lot of progress eliminating sources of coal from our electricity grid over the last couple of decades. So there's been tremendous health benefits already gained by reducing sources of emissions from coal. But it's the question of getting the rest of it off the grid and would probably be the lowest hanging fruit. And the electricity sector generally is going to be the easiest of these sectors to decarbonize. We have a lot of the tools and technologies already available to us to get to a nearly emissions-free electricity grid nationwide in the U.S.
I think a lot of the conversations I've had about things like clean energy and pollution reduction lately have centered around climate change. Do you think that these health impacts need to be more on the map and more part of the policy discussions?
Yeah, I definitely think they do. One of the reasons that we even do this kind of study is partly to say that, yes, these are the same sources of emissions that contribute to global warming and climate-related impacts, but they're also causing tremendous harm to our health every single year, year after year, all across the United States. And you might have to wait 20, 30 years to get the full benefit of avoided global warming from removing emissions from these sources. So that's the climate warming, CO2 pollution, and others. But the benefit you get to human health from removing emissions of fine particulate matter start to accrue immediately after you eliminate a source of emissions. You don't have to wait at all.
You've got this study out. What are your next steps in looking at sources of pollution and the link to our health?
Yeah, so some next steps will be similar studies, but with this study, we asked the question, if you could just flip a switch and tomorrow all these sources were gone, what would the benefit be? But that's obviously not the timeline that reality works under. And a transition to a full clean energy economy is inevitably going to play out over the course of decades. So some of the next steps are trying to understand the timing of these changes, when we could expect changes of these scales or even half the scale to manifest under different future scenarios, and trying to understand what the cumulative benefit would be over that time. So over the next 20, 30 years, how many lives can we save in total from ratcheting down emissions from these sources?
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you.
Nick Mayhew is a graduate student at UW-Madison's Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. He talked to us about his study finding that eliminating air pollution caused by the energy sector would prevent over 50,000 deaths in the United States each year. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about the Ojibwe practice of spearfishing.
Spearfishing is a tradition practiced every spring by Ojibwe tribes in northern Wisconsin. It's a practice that's been passed on for generations, and it's part of tribal rights to hunt, fish, and gather on lands ceded to the U.S. government under federal treaties reached nearly 200 years ago. Earlier this month, WPR's Daniel Kading tagged along with a group from the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, as they taught tribal youth the time-honored tradition of spearfishing.
Lac des Flambeaux Tribal President John Johnson Sr. says the tradition of spearfishing is at the heart of the tribe's name.
When the French came here, they seen our people out in canoes with torchlights, and that's why they call it Lake of the Torches here in Lac des Flambeaux, or Wiswaugeni.
That's the Ojibwe word for the tribe, which Johnson says means Lake of the Fire. For hundreds of years, tribal members harvested fish by torchlight in birch bark canoes at night. As the sun sets over Little Trout Lake near Lac des Flambeaux, Johnson and other tribal members are preparing to take tribal youth out to spearfish for walleye, or oga. Before they head out, young kids take part in a drum ceremony. They sing several songs, including one for tobacco, or asema. Johnson tells the kids to place tobacco in the water. Ojibwe language and cultural teacher Wayne Valier explains Mishipishu, a great water panther, protects the water on behalf of the Anishinaabe people.
When he sees the Anishinaabe putting their tobacco in the water, that makes them happy and pleasant. And what that'll do for us is that'll calm the lake for us. So it'll make it easy for the Anishinaabe to harvest and see the fish.
The group loads up their boats with large tin buckets and aluminum spears around 12 to 16 feet long. Johnson is heading out with his 11-year-old grandson, Ganebic Johnson. Ganebic says he usually goes out with his granddad, who's taught him to share what they harvest to feed their community.
It's important to Native people, and we do this to provide our families, and we just hope we don't get harassed.
Just over 30 years ago, hundreds of people harassed tribal spearfishers at boat landings in northern Wisconsin. They hurled rocks and racist remarks after a federal judge upheld tribal treaty rights to hunt, fish, and gather on off-reservation lands. While there's no sign of trouble on this night, Johnson says not all people know or understand their rights.
They don't realize that we utilize the woods for our food, the lakes for food, and we try to be respectful for it. And we try to save some for the next generation.
Out on the water, Johnson slows the boat as he heads toward a spot near the shoreline where walleye are spawning. His grandson and grandnephew, Liam Armstrong, wear a helmet with a headlamp attached. Johnson says they shine the light from side to side on the shallow water.
The eyes glow. That's all you got to do is catch a glimpse.
It's not long before his grandson, Ganebic, spears their first walleye of the night.
It's there, Ganebic.
Oh, good one, buddy.
9-year-old Liam eagerly waits his turn.
That's what I wanted to do when I grow up. Last year, I got 5 walleyes, and it's fun doing this.
Tribal members take kids out in 4 boats that are each allowed to spear 25 fish per permit. They count the walleye and measure them to comply with tribal regulations when they return to shore. Kids then sit around the fire and swap stories about how many fish they speared. 11-year-old Ryan Mendez speared 6 walleye. He says it's cool that they're keeping this tradition alive.
It's a real great thing. I really appreciate it. I like it. I think it's cool that we can all go out in a boat and have fun time, spear some walleyes, and maybe see a big monster coming your way.
The hope is that these kids will learn and practice their culture, language, and traditions so they can pass that on to future generations.
WPR's Daniel Kading brought us that story on spearfishing. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, we learn how a new music video from a Madison-based recording artist aims to help missing and murdered Indigenous women in the United States. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin marked May 5th as the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Day of Awareness. It's the second year that day was recognized also as a National Day of Awareness. In his 2021 proclamation, President Biden said, quote, thousands of unsolved cases of missing and murdered Native Americans continue to cry out for justice and healing. Madison-based recording artist Kelly Jackson has been using her music to bring attention to this issue. The Ojibwe singer is originally from the Lac du Flambeau band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. Her award-winning albums include Spirit of a Woman and Renditions of the Soul. She recently filmed a music video in Madison for the song Don't Speak, which is from the Renditions of the Soul album. Its premiere was part of an Indigenous-led event raising awareness of violence against women. Kelly, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for the invitation to join you today. I'm excited to share a little bit about what we've been doing in the Madison area.
Well, first I want to share some of your song, Don't Speak. Here's a listen to some of it.
She cries in the dark, shadows in her thoughts, shame overcomes what can't be undone, cold sweats, torn flesh, lost innocence, my independence. Don't speak, don't cry, don't ask, don't try. It's all you can do to get by. Don't think, don't breathe, don't live indiscriminately. It's what we do to get by. It's how we survive.
Kelly, can you tell us some about this song and the inspiration for it?
Wow. Well, to be honest, you know, Spirit of a Woman, my first album, was a tribute to all of the women in my life, aunties, mother, friends, relatives who have helped guide me. I think all of us have had influential women in our lives that, you know, really have uplifted us or kind of lift as they climb. And so my first album was really focused on more of an uplifting kind of environment, where Renditions of the Soul really touched on topics that are a little harder and a little more difficult to process. And I think music's always been an incredible medicinal tool for myself and for my community. And so Don't Speak was really inspired by my own, you know, my own survival, if you will, as a victim of, you know, sexual and physical violence. And I really wanted to explore, you know, more deeply, you know, how this had an impact on me personally, but I guess it also really reflected the fact that I come from an Indigenous community, which is, you know, truly the statistics and the information are very startling when it comes to violence against Indigenous women. And I wanted to, you know, really create a conversational piece that would make it okay to start talking about about this topic. And so Don't Speak was really inspired at the opposite of that, is we're sort of told not to talk about it. It's embarrassing. It's humiliating. And yet the song is really inspiring the idea of we do have to talk about these things. And most importantly, that you're not alone, that there are so many of us, and not just Indigenous women, but women in general, that have had to face, you know, the life events of trauma. And it was a piece that inspired, you know, the, you know, recognition of survival, and even more is the thrival or the thriving that's necessary after someone encounters that experience.
Do you feel like the ice is breaking when people hear your song, for example? Do they think maybe now it's time for me to speak up?
Without a doubt. And I think the song was actually released in 2015, and I would perform it, you know, throughout the world when I was performing. And it always was something that I was highly sensitive of. And oftentimes I wouldn't perform it because maybe it wasn't the appropriate event. But I found that when I did perform it, almost always I would have someone encounter me saying, wow, that really resonated with me. I really had this experience. And, you know, it really was a powerful, you know, expression through music. And so it really made me realize as time went on and as the missing and murdered Indigenous women efforts have really started to, you know, move more into a global spotlight, how it was even more important to bring this, you know, to the surface. And what better way to do that but through, you know, a visual presentation of the song. And it was very challenging for me because I'm not a mental health provider. I'm not an expert in, you know, this area. I'm simply, you know, an Indigenous woman who's experienced that but wants to be part of the conversation. And so even in order to put that visual together and to create and record a music video, I found myself reaching out to other women, women who had been working in the profession, women that had experienced trauma in their life, women that have, you know, looked at how to make an impact, how to impact change. I also talked to other men and Indigenous men on how and what their role could or can be in order to impact change. And it really came together, this idea of in the music video being very diverse, that this happens to all different types of women. And so the video showcases a veteran, a college student, a woman in a domestic scenario, and then, of course, children of sexual assault by a family member. So we tried to be as diverse as we could and yet sensitive enough to, you know, not show actual moments of trauma, although it does have very limited amounts of that. But we wanted to capture the diversity that this issue impacts. And so it was a challenge in the whole construction. But the storyline definitely resonates with a lot of people. And I felt like what a great, you know, a step forward to not just having the conversation, but to launching a nationwide awareness campaign and also essentially a fundraising campaign.
Right.
And I know one of the challenges that I'm faced just as an individual is just when you ask someone, how are you going to impact change? How are you going to impact the better protection of women and girls? How are you going to impact the better services that are provided to women who are in a, you know, victim cycle service line? How do you create change? And I don't think I really know how to do that. And I think the initial launch of this is more information seeking, asking for people's guidance and help on what is the best way for us to utilize music and essentially a partnership. So we've partnered with the Gray Wolf Foundation, which is a local Madison nonprofit organization that is helping us collect revenue and then ultimately helping us decide how to distribute those revenue sources to make the biggest impact. But we do certainly invite advice from others who are working in this sector to help us become better stewards of the awareness campaign, but also where resources can be allocated to make the biggest and most aggressive impact.
And Kelly, you've got this new video, this big partnership, as you say, inviting people to give their perspectives. How would you encourage people to think about this and then to take a step to get involved, whether that's through reaching out to this effort or doing something in their own community?
Well, I think first and foremost, the video itself is called Don't Speak, which is sort of the absolute opposite of what we're looking for. But that's just sort of the message that we're conveying now, is that let's have a conversation. Let's, after this radio program is over, you know, just being able to, as a family, as a community, start having the conversation about what are the services available in your community? What are the challenges that are facing your local communities? Is there a way for you to get engaged locally, or even just to be an advocate for your family or community in some way? So that would be the first call to action. The second would be to reach out to Gray Wolf Foundation. He is definitely collecting advice on how to better serve, you know, this particular cause, and is, you know, currently accepting donations as we speak. They are also putting together what we're calling emergency care packages, which will include, you know, the critical items that a woman or victim may need when they're leaving a traumatic scenario and find themselves without any of the unique and essential items that are needed. So, it, you know, a backpack with essential items, including a phone and gas card, and also just knowing from the community what other services or items might be better served in these packages. So, you know, donations, feedback through the Gray Wolf Foundation. I certainly personally am willing to talk with folks who are interested in reaching out and having a more in-depth conversation with me about how to be a better advocate. We also would like to partner with other foundations and organizations that have similar plights, if you will.
Kelly, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for the invitation. I really appreciate being part of the highlighted programs today. And I really do look forward to working with WPR in the future. So chimigwich in my language. Big thank yous.
Thank you. Kelly Jackson is a Madison-based Ojibwe recording artist, originally from the Lac du Flambeau band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. Been talking about her song and new music video, Don't Speak, raising awareness of violence against women. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, a lot of people switching jobs during the pandemic. Is that the new normal? That and more tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll learn more about the aftermath of the school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, and the long-term impact shootings have on survivors and family members. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, George Floyd was murdered by a Minneapolis police officer 2 years ago today. A former Wisconsin police chief joins the show to talk about the state of police reforms since then. Now, the nation is mourning the loss of 19 children and two teachers who were killed in the shooting yesterday at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. It follows a long string of school shootings, including the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, nearly a decade ago. President Biden called on lawmakers to, quote, stand up to the gun lobby, end quote, and take action to prevent these tragedies.
And don't tell me we can't have an impact on this carnage. I spent my career as a senator and a vice president working to pass common sense gun laws. We can and won't prevent every tragedy, but we know they work and have positive impact. When we passed the assault weapons ban, mass shootings went down. When the law expired, mass shootings tripled. The idea that an 18-year-old kid can walk into a gun store and buy two assault weapons is just wrong.
More details are still coming out about what led up to the shooting in Uvalde. Our guest today has reported extensively on survivors of previous school shootings and the impact of this gun violence on children and their families. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How has the news of this latest shooting affected you? If you're a parent, do you worry about your child's safety at school? Do you try to talk about it with your kids? If so, how? What questions do you have about the impacts of school shootings? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. John Woodrow Cox is an enterprise reporter at the Washington Post, author of the book Children Under Fire, An American Crisis. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thank you for having me.
You talked and you wrote about your conversations with survivors of some of those past shootings, John, and their reactions to that news out of Uvalde yesterday. What kind of things did you hear from, you know, people who had survived these shootings as children and families who lost their kids in those past shootings?
Yeah, I mean, there was certainly a sense of shock. There was anger. There was a deep sadness, but largely there was not surprise. You know, this is a thing that they knew could happen again and inevitably would. And here we are, right? I mean, I think that these are people who, the people I interviewed specifically for this story today, are people who've fought, you know, for change. They have worked hard so that these things don't happen again, but they've seen very little change at the federal level. They, you know, 18-year-olds can still walk into a store and buy assault weapons, as President Biden pointed out. So that sort of sweeping change that that they hoped for but never came, they knew that it would result in a day like we had yesterday.
You've talked to people who have survived mass shootings. What did you learn, and not just high-profile ones, ones we probably never even read about as they happened, what did you learn about the impact on kids after they've gone through something like this and try to later have a normal life?
It's often hard to predict, you know, how a child will react, but in my experience, children have dealt with devastating trauma, lingering trauma. A group of children I wrote about in the book in South Carolina, they're still dealing with it 6 years later. They're still dealing with what they saw that day. And that was a school shooting that took one life and that lasted 12 seconds. And, you know, in one little girl's case, she is probably been to 8 or 9 different therapists since then. She's been diagnosed with debilitating PTSD. She can't go to school anymore. She's on antipsychotics and antidepressants. She has harmed herself, you know, picking at her elbow and pulling at her eyelashes and banging her head against the wall. And you know, a lot of that stems from fear, but a lot of it also stems from guilt. Kids often come away from these events with a feeling of a real guilt that they should have done something to stop it, or that they should have helped their friend who died. You know, and a lot of these kids are not legally considered victims of anything. They're not, because they weren't physically harmed, but they absolutely are victims. And we know too that a huge number of children have been through school shootings in this country. And we have a database at the Post that tracks that very thing. And it dates all the way back to Columbine. In that period, since Columbine, at least 311,000 students have been exposed to gun violence on their campuses. It's a huge number, and a meaningful percentage of those kids are still struggling today.
Democratic Senator Chris Murphy of Connecticut delivered a speech in the Senate urging fellow lawmakers to do something about these shootings and talked some about the experience of the kids in his own state.
In Sandy Hook Elementary School, after those kids came back into those classrooms, they had to adopt a practice in which there would be a safe word that the kids would say if they started to get thoughts in their brain about what they saw that day, if they started to get nightmares during the day, reliving stepping over their classmates' bodies as they tried to flee the school. In one classroom, that word was monkey. And over and over and over through the day, kids would stand up and yell, monkey, and a teacher or a paraprofessional would have to go over to that kid, take them out of the classroom, talk to them about what they had seen, work them through their issues. Sandy Hook will never, ever be the same. This community in Texas will never, ever be the same.
What have you seen, John, about how schools like now, Uvalde in Texas, the kids are going to go back to school someday. The teachers are going to go back to school someday. How do they bring them back?
It's incredibly difficult. It's incredibly hard. You know, kids will be triggered by all sorts of things. Loud noises when they go back. They'll be triggered by sights that they've seen. They'll be triggered by smells. You know, getting kids to a point where they can actually be educated again, where they can learn, where they can figure out how to put numbers together and how to read is going to take a long time. Much of the transition back will just be trying to make them comfortable because some kids will be okay and then some kids won't. And when a kid has an outburst, it's going to affect other children too. So, you know, there is often in the aftermath of these things, we see things like Parkland Strong or Sandy Hook Strong, and that's a noble thing. But also sometimes it can imply that it's time to get over it. It's time to move on. And that is simply not how grief works. It's not how trauma works. These can take months and years for people to not just get back to some version of normal, but to actually be able to function at all. So that's what they're facing. They're facing a really long and difficult road back. And what they need are lots of therapists, lots of adults in their lives who love them, overwhelming support. And it can't end after 3 or 6 months. It needs to be a long-term commitment.
We're talking to John Woodrow Cox, reporter at the Washington Post, author of the book Children Under Fire, An American Crisis, looking at the impact of school shootings like the one in Uvalde, Texas yesterday on survivors, on parents of kids lost in those attacks. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, maybe your experiences. Let's bring on a caller now. Blake is with us in Madison. Blake, hi.
Hi. So I'm a person of color living in Madison. I'm 30 years old. I'm calling in because I want to say if people want change, they're going to have to do it themselves. The last 20 years of politics after Columbine have shown we can't expect progress at the state or federal level. 2 years after George Floyd, we don't have real police reform. Next year, we might see the end of abortion, gay marriage, and racial marriage in Wisconsin if a Republican governor is elected. I won't hold my breath on gun control or, you know, gun laws being put into effect. People need to find their own outlet to enact change in their community. There's the Liberal Gun Club if people want safety education and outreach for parents in their community. There's NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. There's food banks. There's Boys and Girls Club. There's local politicians that we can talk to about affordable housing and living wages, health care.
Blake, I got you a lot there. But John, Blake's initial, it sounded like, I think, frustration with lack of change on issues related to guns, especially with the survivors, you know, and the parents you've talked to. Are they sharing that sense of frustration?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Deep sense of frustration. And, you know, because it's preventable. These aren't natural disasters. It's not a hurricane that showed up in Texas and killed 19 children. These are events that we can stop from happening. And we know they don't have to happen because they don't happen in any other developed nation. Children are not being routinely shot to death in schools in England and Canada and Australia. And when those events have occurred in those places, there has been rapid change, rapid reform. So it's not something that is inevitable. Right. We could choose to do something differently. And that's what these activists, that's what these families understand, is that this is a choice that our society is making, that we're allowing these to happen over and over and over again.
We're talking about the aftermath of the elementary school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, with Washington Post reporter John Woodrow Cox. He's talked to survivors and family members of past school shootings about their reactions, the long-term impact of these attacks. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How would you like to see these school shootings addressed? Have you lived through something like this yourself? 300,000 Americans plus have had an event like this in their school. Are you one of them? What did it change for you or maybe for a loved one? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. We're picking up our conversation with Washington Post reporter John Woodrow Cox, author of the book Children Under Fire, An American Crisis. He's with us today looking at the impacts of school shootings like the one yesterday at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. He has spoken with survivors and parents from past school shootings. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions, maybe your experiences. If you've been in a school as a teacher, a student in the last bunch of years, what are things like? 800-642-1234 when it comes to safety and precautions. Let's go back to your calls now. Sandra is with us in Milwaukee. Sandra, hi.
Hello. I am listening to this as a former educator in a couple of different schools, and a teacher training faculty member. In one of the schools I taught at for a long time, I never thought that the students were at risk, even though there was a shooting nearby and my son was in that school. My principal let me go to get him and remove him from the school. The school was unlocked when there was someone with a gun traveling from school to school. The second school that I was in, another school that I was in, every single day I thought the children were at risk because of the very casual way the possibility of them being hurt was treated. To have a counselor be a part-time counselor and part-time security guard is completely unreasonable. One school that I volunteered in, I will tell you, they had at every entrance, this was a large Midwestern city with plenty of guns, at every entrance, they had a metal detector. These metal detectors were not expensive, but you couldn't get into that school with a large umbrella without
Sandra,
them going off.
Thanks for the call. John, Sandra, seeing a variety of approaches to security at schools, talking to people who've worked on these issues and survived these shootings, do you have thoughts on what people are saying about various security measures?
Well, I can speak to that. I mean, there's a lot of misconceptions out there about, security measures being able to ensure that shootings don't happen. And it's just not based on reality. There have been a great many shootings that have occurred at schools where there were metal detectors. There have been shootings at schools where there were multiple armed resource officers. There have been shootings at really every sort of school with any type of security that you can imagine. There is no sure way to guarantee that a child will not get a gun into a school or that an adult won't get a gun into a school. It's not to say that those security measures haven't helped in certain cases, or that things like training, that those can't be effective. We do know there are examples, but they are not guarantees of safety by any stretch, because we know there have been shootings in all those environments. You know, what we do know is that if the one thing that had changed after Columbine is that adults with guns locked up their firearms and did not allow those firearms to fall into the hands of children, if that was the only change that we made, well more than half of the school shootings in America would not have happened since Columbine. They just wouldn't have happened if we just made that one simple change. So, you know, the one commonality in every single school shooting is the gun. School shooting cannot happen without the gun. And there is no good excuse for a child getting access to a gun and shooting up a school. Certainly, you know, in this case, the shooter bought the gun legally. But in many cases, that's not the case. Children get guns from home. They get guns from friends. They get guns in ways that they shouldn't. And seldom are the negligent gun owners held accountable.
Thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Talking to John Woodrow Cox, author of the book Children Under Fire, An American Crisis, looking at what happens in the aftermath of school shootings like the one at an elementary school yesterday in Uvalde, Texas. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Aaron is with us in Madison. Aaron, hi.
Hey, how are you doing? Thanks for taking the call, and great to hear John on the line here. But you know, we talk about what's been done, you know, after these school shootings happen, and it's clear that it's basically nothing at this point. And I think, you know, I really hope that folks here in Wisconsin understand that the decisions that we make as far as who we put in office does have an impact on kids in Texas. And how we can have a direct impact is by making sure that we don't have buffoons in office that are only concerned with themselves and their own power, like Ron Johnson, and get the right folks in there that'll actually solve these problems and help to move us forward.
Aaron, thanks for the call. John, do you have thoughts on the politics that have emerged just in the last day over this?
Yeah, I mean, your caller is not wrong. There is this sense that Americans are deeply divided on gun reform, gun safety reform, gun policy, and it is not true. polls consistently show that 90% plus of Americans support things like universal background checks. There's widespread support for a lot of other gun policies as well. There's a perception that, you know, America is 50-50 on guns. That's not true. Where there is deep division is in the Senate on Capitol Hill. You know, there are a handful of Americans in the Senate deciding for all Americans what our gun policies will be. And much of that is certainly driven by financial interest. It's driven by the influence of the gun lobby, because no one could argue that the Senate is voting according, precisely according to what Americans want. They're not. There's just been a complete unwillingness among Republican senators to consider any really gun reform. And that was certainly true after Sandy Hook. And I don't see a reason why it would be different today.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll talk more about the politics of gun control here on Central Time coming up on Friday afternoon. John, what kind of support do people need now? The parents who just waited to find out whether they lost a child yesterday, the kids who survived, and as you say, are going to deal with that survivor guilt that they probably don't even understand. What kind of resources, in your experience, do they need the most right now?
They need a lot of opportunity to seek counseling and therapy. I mean, it's a simple thing, but it is critically important. And what that means is, you know, the state needs to fund, and nonprofits, whoever, needs to fund dozens of therapists to show up there, and not just, you know, remotely. They need physically people who are there, and that costs money, and it's an investment, but that's what they need. They need that opportunity. Not everybody will be ready right away, and some people won't ever be ready, but they need the opportunity to seek that sort of help if they need it. And they need, too, is they need patience. They need the rest of the world, their family and friends who aren't there, and the other communities around them to be patient, because there is a very sort of American ideal that, you know, in 6 months, let's get over this and move on. And that is just not the way it works for a great many people.
And John, if I may ask, on a personal level, you, I think, tweeted recently, you've been covering this issue almost exclusively between your reporting and your book, this issue of, you know, what happens to people after school shootings for 5 years now. There's enough of a beat here that it occupies your time. When you see those first headlines break, the first things come up on social media that there's another one, what goes through your mind?
I mean, I feel sick. You know, I felt sick yesterday. It's gutting, because, and I know what those people are headed toward. You know, I know all the pain that that they're going to endure, not just this week, but for years, for the rest of their lives. You know, these people will never be who they were, ever. They can't be. It's impossible, because someone is gone, a child is gone, and it is, it's incredibly painful, and it's deeply frustrating, because I feel, you know, also that it doesn't have to be this way. America is making a choice, and I hope and pray that we'll make a different choice.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's John Woodrow Cox, enterprise reporter at the Washington Post, author of the book Children Under Fire, An American Crisis. He was with us today looking at the lasting impacts of school shootings like the one yesterday in Uvalde, Texas. You can keep following the latest news. We've got stories from NPR at WPR.org. And again, we'll talk more about the politics of gun violence, gun safety, and gun control. That'll be coming up Friday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we take a look at the state of police reform on the 2-year anniversary of George Floyd's death at the hands of a Minneapolis police officer. Two pieces of news out this week from the federal government when it comes to police use of force, when federal agents have to intervene if they see officers from other agencies using unnecessary force, also working with local police departments on those issues. As always, we'll invite your calls. We'll be hearing from a former longtime police chief here in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.